Welcome to this week's edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. To kick off this new year, we've got a list of the top 10 anti-Semites of 2021. Remember to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Now, here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good evening, or good morning, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions, the podcast, and on WKDW Radio. We are delighted you are with us. Happy New Year. Let's all hope 2022 will be a little bit more peaceful than 2021. I'm Mike Deason.
Yeah. Laureen Jaffe. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Laureen, as well. What a year this has been. I'll tell you.
It has. And it's like there's been a lot of good things, but also, you know, some not so good things. But
yeah,
sort of talk about
I think that the COVID virus has dominated our news throughout the world, and certainly here in the United States and in Israel as well, where they have been sort of leading the effort in vaccines and in trying to figure out how to deal with this. I was happy to see. Did you see the story that the Omicron virus has not hospitalized and caused as many deaths in Israel? Same here in the United States.
Right. That, as well as, you know, and what we know also, for instance, in South Africa, where we really saw it first appear and enforce, you know, and I've been listening to the medical doctors talk about it for weeks now. I mean, it has not been serious. It has not resulted in high number of deaths. In fact, the deaths have been significantly lower,
particularly if you're vaccinated.
Right. And it looks like, you know, it quickly reaches peak, and now it's like going on a quick downfall in South Africa. And I think the rest of the world, you know, like as it's sort of reaching its peak now in America, we'll all, you know, I think there's expectation that it will sort of make a rapid decline in later January, February.
Israel, yeah. Did you see, has authorized a fourth shot, another booster
for elderly.
And yeah, I'm elderly. I've had my third. I've had my booster, and for immune compromised people. So the booster really adds a level of protection. And Israel is going at it. They've spent $9 billion on the COVID virus. Did you see that?
Yes, so. I did. I mean, it's a lot of money, but they need to protect their population. I'm grateful that they did. You know, I think the other thing that I think has dominated the news is anti-Semitism from our perspective. So I would like to just start New Year off with Simon Wiesenthal Center's, Simon Wiesenthal Center does a list of the top 10 anti-Semites of the year every year. Another organization also does a list and has a few more on it that we'll talk about today. But I'm just going to quickly rattle through.
Well, the first one is no surprise. The first one is no surprise.
Right, it's Iran, duh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think the rest of the world, the non-Jewish world, realizes what a threat Iran is. I think we're aware because of what we do with this podcast and radio show, and it pops up every week. But I talk to friends who are not Jewish, even some Jewish friends who are not as aware as we are, and I don't think they realize what a threat Iran is.
I mean, I'm always amazed by that, and I think, you know, first of all, I also think American media doesn't really talk about what's going on in the world for the most part, but Iran, you know, the Iranian Brigadier General, you know, most recently saying we will not back off from the annihilation of Israel, even 1 millimeter. We want to destroy Zionism in the world. So, you know, they've been pledged to the destruction of Israel for almost four decades now. The number two anti-Semite, of course, is Hamas, with the May 2021 conflict, where they launched 4,000 plus rockets into civilian populations in Israel to kill Jews.
Let's not move on from Hamas for a second, because it's not just in the Middle East. Pro-Hamas chants in London's Jewish neighborhoods were F the Jews and rape their daughters.
I mean, that's right. That was happening during the May when Israel was under attack and under siege by Hamas. This is pro-Hamas groups and people, you know, look, little socialites, you know, including the Hadid sisters were, you know, on social media, pretty much speaking deathly to the Israel and supporting Hamas, you know, and of course there was a pro Hamas group right in the streets of London, you know, and I think we talked about on the show, some of these comments that were being said, you know, F the Jews and rape their daughters. It was just horrific. And they're, you know, with their Palestinian flags out, waving on the Hamas flags and just supporting Hamas and what was happening. It was really disgusting. So that was number two. Number three,
yeah,
the BBC and the United Kingdom. So you and I have been talking about the BBC for a couple weeks now, some of the more recent stories. But the BBC comes in third place with the Simon Wiesenthal Center for Anti-Semite of the Year.
And probably the worst was BBC reporter Talia Halawa, who said, "Hitler was right. Zionists can't get enough of our blood." This is a reporter with the BBC.
For the BBC.
Yeah, I mean, it is just terrible, you know?
You know, this is the world we live in. I don't, you know, it's awful. The next one, obviously, COVID's latest, the deviant strains. These are the people who pretty much blame Jews, the anti-vaxxers who blame Jews, you know, and spread this anti-Semitism that Jews are the perpetrators of the COVID vaccine the COVID virus in order to make money. So this is a quote from a lawmaker in Lisbon, Portugal. And he says, quote, "The Jews, as they dominate the fiscal world, bought and have the vaccines they wanted. I won't say anything else before the Zionist bulldogs jump." I mean, what does that even mean? Like, there is such spreading of hate of Jews and blaming of Jews for the virus, as we've seen for the last 2 years, that somehow Jews were responsible, and this is all part of the secret Jewish cabal to make money. It's so gross and disgusting. So
a bunch of anti-vaxxers from Washington, New York, and throughout the world wore yellow stars that the Jews had to wear in Nazi Germany, and made it getting a shot, a booster shot, or a first vaccination akin to the Jews being forced to wear stars in the Holocaust.
and I think another one was interesting. In the UK, there was a government report that was issued that noted on over two dozen anti-vaccine networks on Facebook and Twitter. 79% of them had anti-Semitic content, you know, in essence, blaming the Jews again, that somehow the Jews are responsible. Number five might surprise some of you as well.
Yeah, this is upsetting. I find. Go ahead.
Well, you know, Jewish Voices for Peace, which again, it's an oxymoron. I mean, they claim they're Jewish voices, but they're really not. I mean, this is such a small group of minorities, such a very fringe group of minority of Jews, but a lot of them are non-Jews. Most of these are Palestinians who participate in this organization of Jewish Voices for Peace, you know, who very much are anti-Israel, anti-Jew, and don't believe Israel has a right to exist, much support support the Palestinian people and believe that Israel must be, quote, Israel, quote, needs to be eradicated, according to Jewish Voices for Peace.
I told you, when I was in Washington a year or two ago, I saw them protesting on the streets. It really shook me. There were Hasidic Jews who were holding up signs saying, end Israel's domination,
right.
Israel should not exist and all. It really shook me. To the
core.
Well,
that's like a super tiny fringe of the ultra Orthodox, who don't believe that Israel should exist until the Mashiach comes.
But there were people from Jewish Voices for Peace that were in this protest that I
JVP.
Saw. Yeah.
Oh, okay. JVP was that, like, so JVP, I mean, they really are. I mean, they stand for the eradication of Israel. I mean, just they don't believe that they think Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth. Even though Jews have lived in the land for 5,000 years, they don't believe that Jews have any right, even though we're indigenous to that land, that Jews who are there, they have no right to exist there, and they must be removed and annihilated. Kind of frightening. The sixth one was social media giants. I mean, look, we know that a lot of social media platforms have been used for mass marketing of anti-Semitism and bigotry, and it's true. I mean, it's been, whether it's Twitter, TikTok, Facebook, you name it. I mean, we've talked about it. Or this other platform, Telegram. I mean, it's alarming. What I was a little surprised by this one, number seven, Germany. A German anti-Semitism commissioner who, quote, likes social media comparisons of Israel to Nazis. Now, I'm not really sure how you get an anti-Semitism commissioner, how Germany appointed this person. Very alarming, but we know that there are attacks every day, anti-Semitic attacks on Jews every day in the city of Berlin.
Although, you know, we've talked about this before, Angela Merkel, who has left office, really stood up for Jews and against anti-Semitism, which is why this does surprise me that that Germany came in like that, because I thought she really stepped up, as did French President Macron, when we've talked about a lot of anti-Semitic incidents in France as well. But those have been two European leaders that have stood up against anti-Semitism and spoken out very forcefully. So that does surprise me that they are there. But number eight does not surprise me. We've talked a lot about number right. eight. The Council on American Islamic Relations and Sunrise Movement, CARE, who passes
otherwise itself known as CARE, exactly. CARE, you guys probably heard it 1,000 times in the media. The news platforms love to bring people on from CARE to talk. And you and I spoke about specifically Zahra Billow most recently, but they are number eight, and they need to be on everybody's watch list.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. They are labeled a terrorist organization, but are able, they do good PR, pass themselves off as a peace-loving organization. And
right, and yeah, I think the most dangerous thing right now is that they're trying to, they're in essence equating Zionism to Islamophobia and using that as another ideological argument for why Americans should be anti-Israel and anti-Jewish and against the Jews and be anti-Semitic. So, by the way, I love Congressman Richie Torres. He's a congressman from New York, a Democrat. I mean, he is just, I mean, I so applaud him. He's a tremendous supporter of Israel. He's a progressive Democrat. And this is what he was quoted as saying. He said, quote, "There is a concerted effort to ideologically cleanse progressive politics of anyone or anything that dares to believe in Israel's right to exist. The fear-mongering about Zionist organizations has an undeniable current of anti-Semitism," end quote. And, you know, I applaud his courage, because he has come under attack from many of these left organizations, but he is a strong progressive. He is a strong supporter of Israel. He recognizes the anti-Semitism and a lot of these, you know, sort of movements and ideological arguments that CARE and others like CARE make. And I think it's really important that we all continue to call CARE out, because they are given tremendous respect and credibility in U.S. media. And unless we hold the U.S. media to account and make them aware of this, they're going to continue to do it. So it's really alarming. Number nine.
This is alarming as well. Yes.
I mean, this young woman, she is now a graduate student. She was an undergrad student, but now a graduate student at University of Southern California. And she, by the way, for those of you listening, she was and she remains a diversity senator. So for student government, for the graduate program, she is a diversity and inclusion senator. So this woman who is a diversity and
Yasmin
inclusion
Mashaki.
Let's see. Yasmin,
but they don't call her out. They call out the University of Southern California president for his failure to step in and stem the tide of anti-Semitism on the campus.
Or even remove her. They refuse to remove her as a diversity and inclusion senator. So wait till you hear what this young woman says. This 21-year-old Palestinian civil engineering student at the USC's Rabetti School of Engineering. So she says, these are some of her quotes on social media, on her Twitter account. Quote, "I want to kill every mother effing Zionist," end quote. Quote, "Death to Israel and its B blank TCH the US."
Yeah.
quote, "If you are not for the complete destruction of Israel and the occupation forces, then you're anti-Palestinian," end quote. Quote, "Zionists are going to effing pay," end quote. Quote, and this is, she says it in Arabic, curse the Jews. Quote, long live the Intifada. Quote, I effing love Hamas. So this young woman, who is now a graduate student, remains a senator of diversity and inclusion. I don't really understand how, when she clearly doesn't believe in diversity and inclusion and believes that the Jews are, you know, says these horrific things about killing Jews. And I'm pretty sure there's plenty of Jewish students there at USC. And of course, the USC student, the actual president, the president, like the sort of quote unquote, the people that you think would stand up and say, wait a second, student government's gotten out of line. This is not allowed. This violates campus policies. Like, but no, the president of the University of Southern California has refused to really take any action. And this is really horrific. By the way, she's number 9 on Simon Wiesenthal Center's list of anti-Semites for the year. She tops stopantisemitism.org. Stopantisemitism.org. I wanted to say it again for those of you who don't know the organization, you should. She tops their list of anti-Semites for the year.
And then number 10. It's not about the ice cream. It's about enabling an immoral and illegal boycott. Unilever, the parent company of Ben and Jerry's, which is boycotting Israel.
You know, it's so amazing. Like, I applaud every state, Florida, Arizona, New Jersey. I mean, there's just so many of them around the country that are withdrawing state funds from investing in Unilever. They're like, look, you know, we've written letters, we've warned you, we've asked you to reconsider your decision. You haven't, so we're following our policy. If you're going to engage in, you know, discrimination and boycott of Israel, then we're not investing in you. And I think that's a tremendous statement, you know, and Unilever has still refused to do anything about it. But, you know, we have to remember where this all stemmed from, because this all stemmed from the head of the board of directors for Ben and Jerry's, Anuhadra Mittal, she is the one who sort of spearheaded Ben and Jerry's board of directors to do this boycott. And she actually won Anti-Semite of the Year from stopantisemitism.org. Again, the organization has named her, but she was the one behind it all. She has been known, she's been for many years in social media, has posted many, many, many anti-Israel, anti-Semitic tweets about, you know, the destruction of Israel and different things. So I think this is a huge statement. I mean, I hope that people are paying attention. And, you know, by the way, I would encourage you to go on to the Wiesenthal.com, find their top 10 list and share it with friends. You know, as Mike mentioned, a lot of people are unaware of a lot of these things that are happening.
It is worth checking out. Let's turn to a positive thing coming out of Israel. Israel, you know, the world is facing a water crisis, believe it or not, and with global warming and all. And Israel is taking amazing steps, because there's a lot of Israel that's a desert, and it is developing conservation technology that is more important than ever. And we have a piece about just what they are doing in Israel to help the world combat the water crisis and global warming. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli sustainability sector's commitment, ingenuity, and perseverance has become a global model. The why is rather simple. Israel's in the Middle East, an arid part of the world with scarce water sources. So in this case, necessity truly is the mother of invention. Israel's precarious water security made water conservation and innovation a top national priority. And Israeli water planners, scientists, engineers, entrepreneurs, and others have answered the call. How are they doing it? Here are some of the ways Israelis are pioneering water sustainability on the world stage. Israelis have contributed many important inventions to the world, few as important as drip irrigation. Created by Simcha Blass in 1959, it's an incredibly simple yet effective irrigation system. It uses pipes, or drip lines, to deliver water and nutrients to the root zones of crops. Today, innovations help drip irrigation systems operate even more efficiently, reducing the water needed for a farm by up to 70% in some places. Each plant gets what it needs when it needs it. Farmers enjoy higher yields with almost no waste or runoff, all while conserving energy and water. Israelis are helping rural farmers across the globe take advantage of drip irrigation, particularly in Africa. Organizations such as Innovation Africa, a nonprofit that brings Israeli water, solar, and agricultural technologies to villages across the continent, are providing fresh water and drip irrigation in 10 African nations. With over 500 projects, they've helped provide access to clean water for over 3 million people. Israel is a country that's largely arid, with only one sizable freshwater lake. So fresh water is hard to come by. But it does have a very large saltwater source, the Mediterranean Sea. If you heard saltwater and thought desalination, you're spot on. Desalination is one of Israel's most important technologies. The availability of seawater isn't as dependent on the climate or political disputes like inland water sources. And there's also plenty of it to go around. Desalination uses massive facilities to make seawater drinkable, and Israelis are only relying on it more. The country's seventh desalination plant will be completed in 2025, at which point desalinated seawater will account for over 85% of the water Israelis consume. Thanks to homegrown technological improvements and marketplace competition, desalination costs in Israel are dropping, and production is becoming better and more efficient. Like drip irrigation, this one is as simple as it sounds. Israelis recycle and reuse nearly 90% of their wastewater. That's about 4 times higher than any other nation on Earth. Compare that to the United States, which reuses less than 10% of its water. So, how do they do it? Dedicated treatment plants take raw sewage, filter it a second time with microorganisms, and clean it until it's so clean you could drink it, though it's mostly used for agriculture. The Shafdan treatment plant in Petah Tikva, one of 67 such plants in Israel, has been cited as a model wastewater treatment facility by the United Nations. Recycled water, along with desalination, now supports Israeli economic growth and will help Israelis withstand dire droughts brought on by climate change. With global water demand expected to surpass supply by 40% by 2030, learning from Israel's network of recycled water treatment facilities will be of vital importance. There's agriculture, and then there's smart agriculture, or agtech. Agtech brings big data and tech into the mix to maximize crop yields, and Israelis are leading the way. Israeli sustainability entrepreneurs are discovering innovative ways to bring technologies like robotics, drones, artificial intelligence, data analytics, and more to crop production. The result? More crops, better crops, and a more efficient use of resources like water, plant nutrients, fertilizers, and even human labor. Today, Israel's agtech sector is booming, with over 450 companies that help feed the world. Big data isn't behind every Israeli sustainability achievement. Some, like solar energy, are actually relatively simple. Heating water accounts for 25% of residential energy use worldwide, mostly through burning fossil fuels. But solar water heaters can reduce a household's water heating fuel consumption by 50 to 70%. And Israelis are sold on these solar water heaters, which harness the sun's heat to directly heat water, without having to convert it to electricity first. Back in the 1950s, Israelis experienced a severe energy shortage. To combat the rising cost of energy, Tzvi Tavor and Levi Isar created what is now known as the Dud Shemesh, or sun boiler. By the mid-1960s, barely 2 decades after Israel's founding, one in every 20 Israeli households already had their own sun boiler. Israeli companies producing solar water heaters soon began exporting them to other Mediterranean countries like Greece, Italy, and Turkey. After the oil embargo Israel faced following the Yom Kippur War, energy independence became a national priority. In 1976, Israel mandated solar water heaters for all new residential buildings over 8 stories tall, which later expanded to all new residential buildings. Today, Israeli society is the solar gold standard. 85% of Israelis get hot water from solar water heaters, which reduces electricity consumption by an estimated 2 million barrels of oil a year, or nearly $84 million. By contrast, in the US, less than 1% of households have a solar water heater. Israel isn't keeping this all for itself either. Israeli companies export about $2 billion of water tech all over the world every year, particularly to Africa and Asia. Israeli irrigation exports account for 30% of the global irrigation market. And with water crises expected to intensify around the globe as our planet warms, Israelis will likely play a major role in the water sustainability sector for years to come. Israelis are even fine-tuning what, at first glance, sounds like science fiction, creating water out of thin air. Israeli startup WaterGen filters water vapor out of the atmosphere and converts it into safe drinking water. WaterGen's cutting-edge technology is providing water to hospitals in the Gaza Strip, which is suffering from a shortage of clean drinking water, and rural villages in Central Africa, where people would otherwise need to walk for hours to find water. WaterGen's technology has also been used to provide drinking water to the first responders in California and Australia, battling record-setting fires in recent years. Israelis may be leading the charge to help forge a more sustainable model of water consumption, but when it comes to the future of our planet, we're all in this together.
You know, the technology that comes out of Israel doesn't always get the allocates that it should.
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, well, first this of all, you know, and Israel's got all kinds of agreements with his neighboring countries, with Jordan and Egypt, about water sharing agreements and providing water and different things, as well as sharing these ideas. I mean, part of the Abraham Accords was to also share a lot of this water technology with many there in the Gulf states, in the Middle East, where water, you know, is a very precious commodity. And, you know, I think one of the other cool, you know, like you mentioned technologies, I mean, I remember, you know, Israel's been doing this in Africa for decades now, bringing, you know, high-end technology for agriculture and water. I mean, one of the things that they invented was literally this machine that creates water out of air. It sources the water that's in the air from the morning dew, et cetera, and then it makes pure drinking water. And it's just like an incredible technology in some of these arid areas. Bringing this technology to them and allowing these villages to have fresh drinking water. I mean, it changes lives for so many. It's so extraordinary. So I love that story.
I do too. Listen, before we take a break, here's one that really surprised me. I wasn't aware, I've got to admit. But Reverend Desmond Tutu died this past week, and he was praised for all he did against apartheid, which he did wonderful things. But he was a open anti-Semite.
That just blew
me away. I've got to be honest. I was not aware of that. But he really attacked the Jewish people. Listen to this one. He said, well, the Holocaust gas chambers weren't as bad as apartheid because at least the Jews died quickly in there. Come
and he
on.
Said, quote, a neater death, end quote. So you know, you got to remember, you know, Tutu did amazing things in fighting apartheid in South Africa, but he was very anti-Semitic, very anti-Jewish. It wasn't, most of his statements weren't even about Israel. They were directed to Jews, directed at Jews. He's very anti-Semitic. And, you know, he was close with Arafat, and that's why when you had that horrific anti-Semitic UN Durban conference in South Africa in 2001, during the height of the Intifada, when innocent Israelis were being blown up in suicide bombings all over the country. You know, Israel, they had this conference where they decided that Zionism was going to be racism, and everybody, the whole world, like, openly became a celebration of anti-Semitism, anti-Israel, anti-Zionism, all of a sudden became, like, you know, openly accepted. And he was part of that movement. You know, and I think it's really important, but there, you know, there is, he would say, you know, he called Jews, you know, obviously being a powerful Jewish lobby, you know, and that we need to forgive the Nazis for what they did to us.
I was blown away when I saw that. I really was not aware. So shame on me, but wow.
And he said that God sides with the Palestinians. He demands boycotts. And he says, you know, about the Jews, well, Jews aren't like anyone else. We're a peculiar people, and we should be held to different standards,
right,
which are used to judge other people. We should be held to a higher standard, a different standard. I mean, that is open anti-Semitism. I mean, I don't even understand it. Like, and when he'd be confronted with his anti-Semitism, he would say, oh, well, tough luck, or my dentist's name is D. Cohen. Exactly. And that was literally his classic answer. Like,
yeah.
Oh, well, no, my dentist's name is D. Cohen. Like, somehow I'm not an anti-Semite, since I think, you know, Jews got off easy because the gas chambers were a clean death. Like, what disgusting.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is, you know, so a lot of people in the pro-BDS movement and people who support this claim that Israel is an apartheid state, they're like, they always point to Desmond Tutu, you know, Bishop Desmond Tutu, who is this amazing humanitarian, who's won peace, Nobel Peace Prizes and all these other things. And he believes Israel is an apartheid state. And so they point to him like, oh, of course he knows. But no,
he doesn't. We've got to step up when people praise him and say,
exactly,
this, you know, despite
expose the truth.
That's right, expose the truth. Hey, listen, we have got to take a break. We've got a really interesting piece with Scarlett Johansson, who is Jewish. Many of you may not know that, but that's coming up. But first, we'll take this break. This is The Third Opinion.
Third Opinion will be right back. But first, we want to urge you to subscribe to Third Opinion. We don't want to get too complicated here, but the only way we know you're listening is by counting downloads. And the only way we can count downloads is if you subscribe to the podcast and receive it through a podcast provider. It's free to you, and it's a great help to us so we can judge how many people are listening to the Third Opinion podcast. So subscribe to Third Opinion today. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
Lorene, I thought you can hear us on this podcast or on WKDW. So I was talking about Scarlett Johansson. A lot of people probably don't realize that she is Jewish. She's married to Colin Jost from Saturday Night Live, who does the Weekend Update. And she really has a close affection for her Judaism and what happened to part of her family who did not escape. Part of her family did escape from Europe before the Holocaust, but part of it didn't. And this is a piece with her as she discovers more about her family and what it meant to her.
And I promised myself I wouldn't cry. No. But it's hard not to.
It's hard not to.
Now I know why you put the tissues there.
Actor Scarlett Johansson knew that her mother's roots stretched back to Jewish communities in Eastern Europe, but the story of those roots had been lost. We set out to recover those stories and focused on Scarlett's great-grandfather, a man named Saul Schlomberg. Saul immigrated to America in 1910 when he was just 24 years old. He arrived alone with almost no money. Soon he found himself on New York's Lower East Side working in a grocery where he sold bananas, leading Scarlett to wonder about the world her great-grandfather had left behind.
I can only imagine that he was coming from a place where he could not continue to survive. I mean, I think he must have come from some broken place, which would have caused him to go on a journey like this by himself with no security on the other side.
Nothing.
Nothing.
I mean,
that's the real immigrant story.
It is.
You know, just the promise of some opportunity and the faith that you're going to make it on the other side.
Saul's arrival record indicated he was born in a town called Grójec, which is now part of Poland. Scarlett had never heard of the town, but her family has a deep and tragic connection to it because when Saul left, his brother Moshek stayed behind, a decision that would have disastrous consequences. On September 1st, 1939, Hitler's armies invaded Poland. By late February 1942, almost all of Grójec's Jewish residents had been killed or transported to the infamous Warsaw Ghetto. Moshek was about 60 years old at the time. He and his wife had 10 children.
The youngest, Zlata, was about 14.
Wow. That's crazy.
What do you think that must have been like for them to be loaded onto trains like cattle and not knowing where they were going?
And losing each other and everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, you hear stories about men and women and children all being separated and that was it, you know, never see the other person again. I cannot imagine what you must be feeling. Just hell. It must have been hell.
At its height, over 400,000 people were forced to live in the Warsaw Ghetto, an area less than 2 square miles. Dozens of people died each day of starvation and disease. Those who endured faced deportation to extermination camps. We wondered what happened to Scarlett's family. We found the answer in a testament submitted to Israel's Holocaust Museum by a woman named Miriam Margolith. Miriam was one of Moshek's daughters.
Family name, Schlamberg. Mm-hmm. First name, Moshe. Mm-hmm. Wartime location, Warsaw Ghetto. Circumstance, time, and place of death unknown. Children's names under the age of 18 that perished. Zlata, age 15, time and place of death, Warsaw Ghetto. Mondel, age 17, time and place of death, Warsaw Ghetto. Wow. That's sad. That is crazy. It's crazy to imagine that Saul would be on the other side selling bananas.
Oh, yeah.
On Ludlow Street.
Yeah.
And how different it would be being in America at that time. The fate of one brother versus the other.
Yeah.
It makes me feel more deeply connected to that side of myself, that side of my family. I didn't expect that.
Moving piece. A very moving piece.
So, I love her. So yeah. She's one of my favorite actresses. But some of you may recall, I mean, she's a South African Jew, but some of you may recall several years ago, she was doing the commercials and advertising for SodaStream. And SodaStream had a manufacturing facility in the West Bank. And the BDS movement called for a boycott of SodaStream, was attacking her. And all kinds of things. And she proudly said, I'm not backing up and I'm not backing down. And she just, you know, just kept on doing those ads, those advertisements for SodaStream. And I'm just so proud of her for being proud of her Judaism and not giving, because many in Hollywood give in to the bullies on social media, the pro BDS, anti-Israel bullies who, you know, they're nasty and that's all they do. They just attack. Rah, rah, rah. So,
right.
So speaking of which, one of Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, also known as AOC, one of her staffers this week on social media called Israel a racist European ethno state. And there have been calls for AOC to condemn it and to respond, and she has remained silent, which doesn't surprise me because, you know, this is the same woman who, you know, decided to sign a bill with Congresswoman Rashid Tlaib calling to strip tax exempt status from any U.S. charity that supported Israeli settlements. And she also withdrew her attendance from the memorial Yitzhak Rabin. I mean, she has, you know, constantly said F you to the Jews and to Israel many times. And I think it's really alarming. Of course, she was in our state of Florida. She actually, for those of you who didn't know, apparently she was spotted vacationing, wanted to get out of New York and get out of her you know, little hellhole up there that she oversees to have some freedom in Miami Beach this past week and party up down there. So, you know, I'm not sure that I like her being in my state. and you know,
there was a lot of pushback, though, against the staffer who said that. Hey, before we forget, I want to talk a little bit about the Jewish people that we lost this year, some real giants.
Oh, yeah.
That we lost, including Ed Asner, who was just a terrific actor, also on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and we lost Betty White this week, who is not Jewish,
but we loved her though.
Yeah, and then George Segal, who I always loved, and then he was on the Goldbergs playing Pops for several years, and he passed away this year. Larry King. Passed away. Did you know Larry King, for those of you in Tampa, his grandson went to Hillel here in Tampa. Did you know that? His son, Larry King, has a son. He's been married like about 8 times or something like that. But one of his sons lives in Tampa, and his grandson went to Hillel, and King went to Hillel a couple of times, apparently, to see his grandson. Who else did we lose here? Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah, well, Sheldon Adelson, I felt like was one of the biggest. I mean, Sheldon Adelson was he was the founder of the movement to bring young Jews to Israel. Oh my God, my brain just went blank.
The Birthright. The Birthright.
Birthright. Thank you. And funded it and supported it. And you know, I mean, really, I mean, it's interesting because he had a very difficult childhood. You and I talked about this when he died at the time of his memorial. Very poor, sort of came from nothing, fought to build incredible wealth, which he ultimately did. His wife, his second wife.
Although he used his political power. I didn't like the way he used his wealth for political power. I think money ruins politics, right. Quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, look, he was involved in politics, but I think he's, you know, beyond that. I mean, there's, you know, I'll remember him for just how much he did to support and really to help the Jewish youth in this country, you know,
Return I will remember him for the candidates he supported, many of whom I disagreed with.
I'll remember him for his good that he did for Israel and for the Jewish youth in this country. Because I think that, to me, that was probably, that's a lasting legacy that will go on for many generations. Yeah. And I you know, I think he doesn't get enough credit for that, but he did some incredible things.
He did some good things. He did some good things. Bernie Madoff also died this year. We won't spend much time talking about him. I mean, he ripped off so many Jewish charities as well as thousands of other people.
And the AJC, the American Jewish Committee, is still trying to recover. I mean, the AJC, which was like the voice of the Jewish world in America for decades, lost like a huge percent of their funds.
Because they invested. Listen, we've got another interesting piece. We've been talking a lot about the problems at the Wailing Wall, which is what's left of the remnants of the Second Temple. And there's been a lot of controversy there between Islamic folks and Jewish folks and praying there, and even with Orthodox Jews and allowing women there and all. And I thought it'd be interesting to see just how we got that Second Temple. This is a fascinating piece that I learned a ton about the building of the Second Temple and the remnants of the Wailing Wall. Let's take a listen.
Ezra and Nehemiah were born into a community of Jews that had been forcibly exiled from Judea and relocated to Babylon after the destruction of the First Temple. They lived in what was known as the Persian diaspora around the year 450 BCE. They both returned to Judea with a mission. Nehemiah came to rebuild the ruined city of Jerusalem, and Ezra came to rebuild the Jewish soul. Before we can even get into the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, we should do a little background. After the exile, the Jewish community in Babylon went into lockdown and isolated itself in order to preserve its identity and to keep its members from assimilating. Laws against intermarriage, which had been at times ignored in Judea, were now being strictly enforced in Babylonia. Judaism in Babylonia maintained itself with its sacred books and its separate schools of study. For 50 years, the Jewish community was not allowed to leave Babylonia, and then a miracle happened. A Persian king named Cyrus took control of the Babylonian throne. The Babylonian Empire collapsed, and the Persian Empire now began. And here is where the book of Ezra starts. In 538 BCE, the new king Cyrus issues a decree. The Jews are free to go back to Judea. King Cyrus returns the looted contents of the First Temple to the Jewish community and vows to underwrite this new Second Temple's construction. Now, before you think Cyrus is a really nice guy, let's keep in mind what he's getting out of this. By allowing the Jews to rebuild their temple and practice their religion in Judea, Cyrus gains their unconditional loyalty, especially since he will be paying for the project and controlling the money. It gives him a foothold in the area without having to move a single soldier there. The idea of moving back to Judea electrifies the community of exiles. While many in the Jewish community of Babylon have grown comfortable and decided to remain, 42,000 exiles leave a country that they lived in for 50 years and return to a land that was then called Yehud Medinata, Aramaic for the state of Judah, Aramaic being the international language of the day. This return was, in a sense, a precursor to the Zionist movement that would again take place some 2,500 years later. When the 42,000 arrive in Jerusalem, they find an abandoned, burnt-down city whose walls are breached and collapsing. They get to work. It takes 2 years just for the foundation of the next temple to be completed. The community gathers together in great celebration. The elderly who knew Solomon's temple weep with mixed emotion. Temple construction proper is set to begin. And then, as luck would have it, King Cyrus dies in battle. A municipal governor, along with the local people known as Samaritans, used this opportunity to try and get the project stopped. According to Ezra, the Samaritans were a people who had moved in and filled the vacuum left by the Jewish exile. They were practicing a competing version of Judaism, and they had a temple of their own. They tell the new king of Persia that Jerusalem is, quote, a rebellious city, harmful to kings and states. If this city is rebuilt and its walls are completed, you will no longer have any portion in the province of Judea. The king gets the message. All work building the temple is forcibly halted. A generation passes. Another guy, King Darius I, takes the throne. The Jewish community restarts temple construction before even getting permission. Again, the Samaritans appeal to King Darius to stop the project. The new king checks the archives and he discovers that yes, Cyrus had in fact commissioned and paid for the rebuilding of the new Jewish temple. Darius I greenlights the project and orders the tax treasury in Samaria to pay for the rest of the construction. Work now begins in earnest. In 516 BCE, 70 years after its destruction and 23 years after the start of the return from exile, the temple is completed. It's made of hewn stone and inlaid with wood from the king's forests. The Israelites, the priests, and all the returning exiles celebrate in great joy. A sacrificial party rededicates temple service. We have officially entered the Second Temple period. You might have noticed at this point that even though we're talking about the Book of Ezra, Ezra has yet to show up. To meet him, we need to skip ahead another 50 years. So, 50 years after the Second Temple is finished, the next king of Persia, King Artaxerxes, asks a man known as Ezra the Scribe, there he is, to, quote, regulate Judah and Jerusalem according to the laws of your God. The new community in Judea is, frankly, not doing very well, and Ezra, a great scholar in the books of Moses and a priest in the Persian Jewish community, is sent by the king to reestablish Jewish culture and to create the local judicial system. He will be the new spiritual leader of Judea. In essence, the first chief justice of the new nation. After his long journey, Ezra arrives to find that many in the Jewish community, including community leaders, have intermarried. This news is extremely traumatic to Ezra. He tears his clothes, he goes into public mourning. Ezra comes up with a desperate solution. He orders all the Jewish men to divorce their non-Jewish wives and to expel them and their children from the community. Ezra was deeply concerned that the Jews of Judea were violating divine law and that they would assimilate and vanish into history. What's more, the Persian Jewish community believed that God had destroyed the first temple for the sins of the people. We just finished building the second temple. Ezra doesn't want this temple destroyed as well. Ezra's book abruptly ends here. But don't worry, Ezra will show up again in the Book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah, at the opening of his book, is cupbearer to the same king Artaxerxes. That means he's the king's sommelier, the wine steward, which is a title of high rank in any palace. One day, Nehemiah is talking to some Judeans visiting the palace and learns that the people of Judea are in really bad shape. He also learns that the walls of Jerusalem are still breached and that the city is vulnerable to attack. He asks the king of Persia if he, Nehemiah, could be made governor of Judea to take care of and protect his people. King Artaxerxes allows it, and he sends Nehemiah to Judea with a letter to the keeper of the king's park. The keeper is to supply Nehemiah with all the lumber he might need for any project he deems necessary. When Nehemiah gets to Jerusalem, he sees that the stories are true. Sure, the temple's been rebuilt, but the walls are still breached and the gates are still destroyed from the Babylonian siege 130 years earlier. A volunteer workforce is assembled. They're motivated, to say the least. The breaches to the walls and the city gates are all repaired in 52 days. With the city secured, Nehemiah now addresses another quality of life issue, the scourge of debt. There's a rich upper class in the state of Judah. The majority of the Jews, however, are poor and indebted to the wealthy. People have sold their fields and have even sold themselves into bondage, all in hope of gaining relief, but the debts keep mounting. Nehemiah gathers the community together. In this assembly, the poor vastly outnumber the rich. He publicly shames the members of the upper class who indebted their brethren. The Jews have been brought out of indentured servitude in Persia at great expense, he tells them. It was not so they could now live in indentured servitude in Judea. One after another, Nehemiah has the predatory lenders step forward, forgive the debts owed them, and return the people's land to them. This is, in effect, the first sabbatical year of this new Jewish community. This is where Ezra shows up in Nehemiah's book. The two work together. Ezra reads the Torah of Moses, i.e. the Bible, to the entire community, men and women, from dawn to midday, while priests translate and explain. There was not yet a custom of regular public readings of the Torah, and the people are completely overwhelmed. They weep hearing the words of God. Ezra, Nehemiah, and the priests tell them, this is the day of celebration, there's no need to be sad. 24 days later, Ezra again convenes the community and again reads the Torah to them. The community leaders are inspired and they sign a pledge to follow the teachings of God given through Moses. They vow not to intermarry. They vow to let the land lie fallow and to forgive all debts every 7 years. They vow to pay a tithe, meaning a tenth of their income as a tax to the temple, and to maintain the temple with food and sacrifices and fuel for the altar. They vow not to buy goods from the locals on the Sabbath. Nehemiah continues his work. Though Jerusalem's walls are rebuilt, the city inside is still mostly ruined. Most Jews opt to live out in the countryside. Nehemiah's people draw lots, and he forcibly moves one out of every 10 Judeans back into the city. And then he comes across the same problem that Ezra had been struggling with. The community continues to intermarry, and now their children don't even know how to speak Hebrew. Nehemiah resorts to flogging the men who have non-Jewish wives. Nehemiah ends his book with a prayer to God. He says, "I purified the priesthood and the people and reestablished the temple service." He's essentially saying to God, "I did everything I could." Thus ends the second to last book of the Bible. For his part, Ezra is credited with adding new and important elements to Judaism. His gatherings of the community to read the Torah of Moses established the practice of publicly reading the Bible every Monday and Thursday morning, as well as every Sabbath afternoon. Later, the rabbis of the Talmud added a reading to the Sabbath morning service. Ezra is also credited with convening the first Great Assembly, a deliberative body of prophets, scholars, and judges that later became the Jewish Supreme Court of the Second Temple period. He's also credited with writing his self-titled book, as well as the books of Malachi and Chronicles 1 and 2. The framework of the Jewish biblical canon, known in Hebrew as the Tanakh, starts with the creation of the world and ends with the building of the Second Temple. Unfortunately for later generations, the policies of the Roman Empire and the Jewish response to them would lead to the destruction of the Second Temple, which stood as the center of Jewish sacrificial worship for 580 years.
It blew me away. It was a pretty fascinating piece and went on for a long time, but probably the most religious piece of anything in Israel. Would you not say?
Right. And I think it's really important. The story is important because so much of this anti-Israel movement is to rewrite history and pretend like Jews have no connection to the land and no connection to Jerusalem. Even this week we saw, we've had, as you all may remember, we had Dumasani Washington on, who was also the founder of the Mizrahi Project, which I encourage you to go online and when view the videos of the Mizrahi Project. These were Jews from all over the Middle East, Northern Africa, et cetera, who were forced to flee their homes with nothing, because of the anti-Semitism and go to Israel. And these Mizrahi and Sephardic Jews really were made up the vast majority, and even still today, the vast majority of Jews in Israel. But there was this 52 quote-unquote Arab intellectuals just signed a letter in France to protest the Institute of the Arab World, the IMA, concerning an exhibit that the French President Emmanuel Macron has brought into Paris called Jews of the Orient. And it focuses on these Mizrahi Jews, 850,000 of them who were forced to flee, whether it was, Morocco, Ethiopia, Tunisia, Libya, Iraq,
and we can't name
Syria,
anymore. We can't name anymore, Lorene, because you hear that music. That means we are out of time. Happy New Year, everybody. Thank you for being with us. We're available wherever your podcasts are available to you and on WKDW Radio. This is The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe. Happy New Year.
Bye.
That's our podcast this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.